It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the latest Wisconsin jobs numbers are out, showing lackluster growth in the past 12 months. We'll take stock of how this could affect the race for governor.
First, we're going traveling through the worlds of fiction.
Welcome to Hogwarts. Now, in a few moments, you will pass through these doors and join your classmates. But before you can take your seats, you must be sorted into your houses. They are Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin. Now, while you're here, your house will be like your family.
From Hogwarts to Hobbiton to fictional versions of real cities like Los Angeles, Albuquerque, and Baltimore, authors and movie and TV directors have created a huge variety of interesting, compelling places.
And we want to hear your favorites. Share a place from books, TV, and movies that drew you in, that made you feel like it was a character in that book, that made you want to visit, maybe stay far away from, maybe a place you wished was real so that you could vacation there or live there forever. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Rob Weiner joins us now. He's a librarian and resident pop culture expert at Texas Tech University. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hello. Well, good afternoon. Thank you.
For you, what makes a compelling, memorable place in a fictional setting?
Well, I think it's just sort of grasping something that just grabs us, you know, and touches someone uniquely in their soul some way, you know, something that just, I guess it just sort of grabs us individually. Mm-hmm. And touches us that in a way that makes us want to seek out that place. Like for me, it would be Marvel Comics in New York. Like I would want to see the Baxter Building or the Fantastic Four live or the Daily Bugle where Spider-Man works, you know. And of course, you know, Walter White's home in Albuquerque would be really cool. And, you know, there's a whole industry around that. But I think it's one of those things that people, whether it's from a novel, television, movies, they're touched in some way. They relate to it, whether it, you know, it's Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or Breaking Bad.
Now, some authors seem to be incredibly gifted at world building. They're not just telling a story, they're building an entire world. What makes a world like that come to life?
Well, I think it's having those key characteristics of you've got characters interacting with that world, you humanize it in some way where the audience sees that world built. And, you know, when it's movies, they're building it. I mean, like in Lord of the Rings, right, they built Hobbiton. Hmm. And all of a sudden, in New Zealand, there was this huge tourist trade, people coming to take a look at that. And, for example, my good friend and colleague and professor of electronic media, Dr. Robert Peasley, just got back taking a group of students at Texas Tech to New Zealand to study tourism of Hobbiton. And he did his whole PhD dissertation looking at fandom and tourism at a fictional place like Hobbiton. And if you know, and in Albuquerque now, they've jumped on to the Breaking Bad tourism aspect because, you know, and the show just won all these Emmys, right? Just this last week. So, it's a way for places to boost their economy as well. It should be, you know, because people are interested in these fictional places. And so why not? But I think it's whether it's filmmakers, novelists, you know, writers of television scripts, et cetera, if they're able to tap into something that gives people something to look forward to you know, sort of re-energize the viewer's or reader's mind, brings them into that world in a way that is creatively possible.
Well, it's amazing. You know, I wonder how many generations of people over the years read the Middle Earth books, Lord of the Rings. And wished they could go to Hobbiton.
Now,
I mean, for a decent outlay of cash, I suppose you could.
Yeah, you can, and you know, it's one of those things that in New Zealand it gradually built up. I mean, they initially sort of demantled it, but people started coming.
If you build Hobbiton, they will come.
yeah, you know, and it's, who knew, that this was going to be economically viable. But I think it's depending on how successful a series is, or a television show, movie, novel. Certainly, as we know, you know, it's all supply and demand, right, for these kinds of things. And economics dictates practically everything that's related. Not always, but it dictates a lot. And it's amazing just how many fictional places people are interested in or think are real. I mean, you know, working in the public library for many, many years, I had people that would come to me and want to know exactly where the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house was, where the real murders happened. Well, you know, that's not real. Of course, we know the story of Ed Gein and so forth, and Plainfield, Wisconsin, et cetera, et cetera. But that Leatherface was loosely based on Ed Gein, but there is no Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? I mean, there's a house where they filmed it, but that's not what people were asking for.
Well, I want to bring in our callers now. We're asking for your thoughts on the best places from the worlds of fiction, books, TVs, movies, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jean-Marc in Middleton. Jean-Marc, hi.
Hey, guys. My comment is actually based really on that world-building concept. And when it comes to world-building in a fictional setting, I don't think anybody even comes close to Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And specifically what I mean is, like, for example, I read all the Harry Potter books and enjoyed them well enough. But, you know, in Harry Potter, everything kind of happens in England, and you don't even know, considering it's built kind of on Earth, that America exists, or they sometimes mention that Romania exists, but that's all that really exists outside of the immediate world. Whereas in Tolkien's world, I really get the feeling, and I love reading nonfiction as well, and sometimes I almost fall into the mystery of believing it's a nonfiction world where this entire history exists in a way that I don't think anybody else can write or had written or has written, and he is just choosing to tell one element of the story therein. And you can really believe that everything else exists around it.
Right, yeah, I agree with you. I feel exactly the same way. And it's hard to top Tolkien. I mean, the guy wrote an entire language to go along with his world. He really was invested in the world building.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of that comes from Finnish folktales, though. I mean, Tolkien, you know, was a professor of languages, and he drew from some of those sources. But, nothing tops that. I mean, and it's so detailed. Have you ever read The Silmarillion?
I've just started it. Honestly, I found it a bit of a slog. I didn't quite make it through.
Yeah. I've never been able to get through it either. But The Silmarillion is all that history, and continues that world building, and it's just, you know, it's as difficult as it is to get through. It's an amazing piece of work if you can get through it. I've never been able to, and I know a lot of people who haven't, but.
We're talking right now to pop culture expert Rob Weiner about fictional places. What makes a good one, one that really comes to life in a book, movie, or TV show?
You can join in with your favorites right now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite world or city or other place from the world of fiction? What makes it compelling? Would you want to visit or even live there? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation after a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the best fictional places of all time. Rob Weiner is with us. He's a librarian and pop culture expert at Texas Tech.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What fictional world, fictional place grabs you, captures your imagination? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's listen to one that I think really stood out in the movie it's from.
Mos Eisley Spaceport. You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
So I like that one a lot because Mos Eisley and the cantina, it points toward a wider universe. You see all these species. They don't really play a part in the story, but it tells you, hey, we've got this story. It's like you were saying, Rob, about Lord of the Rings. We've got this story, but there's a lot more out there.
Yeah, well, and you know, the planet Tatooine, and it's kind of like that. Mos Eisley is kind of like the space version of Gotham, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gotham's one of the most famous fictional places. It's home to the coolest superhero ever created, Batman, right? But I'm not sure I'd ever want to live there.
You don't want to live in a wretched hive of scum and villainy?
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, you know, even though it's got, you know, the coolest villain of all, who I'd never want to meet, but he is the coolest villain ever, you know, the Joker, and the coolest superhero. So, but I love reading stories about Gotham, and I love reading Batman and watching the movies, but I don't think I would ever want to visit there. Would you?
It's a dark place.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean, what do you think?
I would not want to live there, but I think you're right. I think Gotham pops because of, you know, the reasons you're talking about. It stays with us, so it really is. It takes New York, and it tweaks it just enough.
Yeah, and the way it's been portrayed in the movies, you know, the sets from the Tim Burton movies through the Christopher Nolan ones look amazing, right? But yeah. Or the way that they're portrayed in the recent comics, but I would not want to visit there. Metropolis, on the other hand, I might want to visit, you know, hang out with Superman, unless it's being destroyed, like in the last movie, but Man of Steel. It's a little brighter place, although not as interesting.
Right, it's more boring. Let's get back to our callers. You've got Mary on the line in Eau Claire. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the dystopian community in The Giver.
Yeah,
I just fell in love with that one from the first time I read it years ago, and just how, I don't know, creepy and controlling the entire community is. Not somewhere I would like to live, but... And then if you read on into the other books in the series, you learn about these other communities in that universe as well.
Have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't yet. So I don't know what the movie's like, but the books are really great.
Yeah, the books are great. And I really like the movie. I thought it was better than The Hunger Games so forth, and some of the other films that have come out recently. I'd be real curious to know what you thought about its portrayal in the movie. Those books are great. I don't quite understand why they're considered kids' books, because they're so dark, and I'm not sure if I had children I'd want my kids reading them. But it's a really interesting society that they set up there. As a dystopian society, and I certainly wouldn't want to live there, but it's not too far-fetched either.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for your call, and we're going to move next to Nick in Abrams. Hi, Nick.
Hello. Thank you, guys. I think this is a really awesome program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, I just wanted to mention I'm a bit of a younger listener, and you mentioned TVs and movies and books, all of which have really great worlds. But I think you might be missing out on video games
listeners. Yeah, sorry. I totally agree with you. I'm not a gamer myself, but a lot of my good friends are, and I respect and love video games for what they do with pop culture and video game. Yeah, things like The Last of Us and what's your favorite? And what's a world that you like in video games?
Well, there's a series of games called the Elder Scrolls games, and they take place on the fictional continent of Tamriel, and they actually spend time making actual libraries of books talking about history, and the folklore and, you know, certain people and time in this game. So you can actually, you know, walking through a world, find a book in someone's bookshelf and read about the world that they have made in this video game.
Wow. That's amazing. And yes, thank you for pointing that out. That's most appreciated. Video games are an incredible way to actually interact and experience those worlds.
That's true. They've definitely come a long way since, you know, Space Invaders. Not a lot of depth of place there. Nick, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Sherry in Milwaukee. Sherry, hi.
Yeah, hi. You guys have already talked about Harry Potter. That's number one for me. I feel like I've been there because I think the movies, to me, did such a good job of bringing the books to life. And also the world of Jurassic Park.
Uh-huh.
But in my mind, I think there is a place where there are dinosaurs, really. Like, I can't separate the reality from the, they did such a good job. You know, I'm sure now, looking back, it might not look as cool as it did at the time, but it was just stunning. And
right.
I felt it was, like, real.
It was. They did a beautiful job. You know, it's an island. I can't remember. Was it Costa Rica or something off the coast of Costa Rica? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it seemed totally believable. I don't know if you'd want to live there,
right.
If you want to be Dino Chow, but it was well brought to life. What do you think about that, Rob?
And in fact, you know, that first Jurassic Park was quite revolutionary in its use of computer animation for its time, and it really pushed some of the boundaries of bringing the unreal to life, as it were, and suspended our disbelief. And there have been so many knockoffs. You know, I recently rewatched the 1998 Godzilla, unfortunately, and talk about a knockoff of the original Jurassic Park. So, that's a really, really good example. Thank you. What do you think about asking our caller about the reboot that's about to happen?
Well, she's dropped off the line, so we'll have to leave that to our imagination. Jen on Facebook writes, I would love to visit Twin Peaks for a ski vacation or even compete in the Hunger Games arena. What? But I actually have a sadness inside my heart that Hogwarts and Harry Potter, that they don't exist.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Twin Peaks, at least stopping by for some pie and coffee, but I think I'd want to move on before too long, before the weird stuff starts happening.
Yeah, you know, Twin Peaks is one of those that really still has a tremendous cult following, and I think it's a series that David Lynch should have been given a little more free rein to do what he needed to do. With that series, it never realized its full potential and still has a lot of fans to this day.
We'll take a quick call from Rock in Black River now. Rock, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Rock?
I wanted to just talk about the, I think it would be really cool if you can, if you could be, like, in a game, Resident Evil.
Ooh. A lot of zombies there. So
yeah.
Resident Evil. Rock, thanks for that. A Dangerous Place. I know you're a zombie fan. Rob, before we let you go, do you have a favorite zombie world?
I have favorite zombie movies, but I certainly wouldn't want to live in any zombie apocalypse, to be quite honest with you. So I don't have a favorite, as it were, that I'd want to actually experience. Because I would argue that if the zombie apocalypse happens, it's over. I don't think we're prepared in any way for it. Even though there are lots of people who try to make us prepared, you know, in The Walking Dead and World War Z and things like that. Mm-hmm. I would say the most interesting that I've seen, even though I'm not a gamer, is The Last of Us. That world that I've read about and seen. That's pretty interesting.
Well, Rob, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
That was Rob Weiner, librarian and pop culture expert at Texas Tech. You can keep sharing your favorite fictional places, the places you want to go, the places that really pop for you on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, Veronica, you and I were brainstorming earlier some of our favorites. I had the future Los Angeles in Blade Runner, this amazing postmodern retro landscape, and a book, China Mieville's New Crobuzon, this amazing city. Zillions of alien species in it, or fantasy species, you can't necessarily tell, but it seemed like a real place for all the fantastic elements in it. What are some of yours?
That sounds great. And I nominated The World, which was our world, in Deborah Harkness's Discovery of Witches trilogy. You know, it has these intellectual, you know, university professors who happen to be vampires. It's fantastic. I would live in a world with vampires if they were like that.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to live there, but I think both of us might want to tour the castle Winterfell from the Game of Thrones.
Right, as long as the wolves are there.
Right, to protect us?
I don't know. They're pretty cool wolves, though. Well, we want to hear what you have to say. You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
The theme from Blade Runner takes us out now. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll learn how to make delicious Vietnamese banh mi sandwiches at home.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development reported late yesterday that private sector jobs grew by only 1.3% in the 12 months ending in March.
Those state-by-state comparisons won't be out until mid-September. Analysts believe these latest numbers won't be likely to affect Wisconsin's ranking as 37th in the nation when it comes to job growth.
The jobs report follows on the heels of the Walker administration's announcement of a significant shortfall in revenue during the last fiscal year. This could drop the state budget into the red in the coming year.
And all of this is going on against the backdrop of a very close race for governor. WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson joins us now. Welcome back, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, looking at these numbers, 1.3% job growth, it's not a disaster, but not exactly a barn burner when it comes to the economy.
No, it's not a barn burner. It's kind of remarkably consistent with what Wisconsin has seen lately. I mean, it's pretty close to what Wisconsin saw a year ago in a similar report that ended in March of 2013. So, yeah, it's not, you know, clearly not an economy that's taking off. If you couple this with, you know, recent revenue estimates that showed the state taking in less money than expected, you know, it appears to be an economy that's slowing down a bit.
Are people pointing toward particular factors behind that somewhat tepid growth?
You'll hear different explanations for it, I guess. I mean, it's political season, and so right now these numbers are sort of caught up in that political volley between Mary Burke and Scott Walker. And so, you know, the Burke campaign is framing it in terms of what has Wisconsin done since Scott Walker took office, you know, since January of 2011. And if you compare those numbers to other states, they are not good. I mean, Wisconsin does trail its Midwest neighbors in job growth. It trails the nation. If it had grown at the rate of the nation, it would have added, you know, somewhere close to 60,000 more jobs. So, you know, that's what you hear from, you know, the one side.
And in the governor's camp? What's
the, you know, he's not. These are the numbers that he said during the recall campaign you're supposed to look at. These are the economists will back that up, actually. The quarterly census of employment and wages, highly accurate, as the name implies. They are a census of employers. They come from unemployment insurance records from about 96% of employers. So the governor really built these up a couple years ago, so it's hard for him to kind of walk away from them, even though he's trying to do that now. So what he's been trying to do is say, look, we're still growing better than they did in the Doyle years when Mary Burke was Commerce Secretary.
We have these numbers now, but it's kind of weird. It's a sneak preview of the official federal state-by-state numbers. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And this is something that again, it was the first time that they did it was during the recall campaign. The Walker administration has taken to releasing these quarterly census of employment and wages early. And so they come out, you know, the state's added that many jobs. You know, the state, you know, private sector grew by 1.3% from March to March. And then you're sort of left to say, well, so what? How did that compare to the nation? And we'll find that out, I believe it's September 18th, so you don't have to wait too long for that. But, you know, a year ago at this time in that March to March period, I think Wisconsin was 34th and had very similar growth to what you're seeing here. And if you look at the last census report that we had that covered all of 2013, so December to December, that was Wisconsin was 37th, and it added about 28,000 jobs. So there's not a lot sometimes in terms of percentage growth that separates you 37th from 38th. So I think to say, yeah, we're going to be 37th in the next report, nobody can make that claim exactly. But you know that you're in the ballpark, and this is the pace that the state's economy has been growing at, and certainly nowhere near the pace of the nation's.
Looking at this again in the context of the race for governor, it seems like as we're going on, it keeps coming back to jobs.
It does, and I think part of that is because of the way that the governor framed his first campaign. I mean, every political campaign talks about jobs, especially given the way that the economy has been for, you know, a decade or more now. Any political campaign is going to talk about jobs. But in Wisconsin, I think Governor Walker really set the table 4 years ago for this, the discussion we're having today, because he made such a huge promise, and he was so unequivocal about it. And he was going to help help the state create 250,000 jobs. You know, it's a big number. It's a number he repeated often. He said he should be judged by it. You know, pretty much he was really just unequivocal about it. And so here we are in 2014. He's at about 102,000, given the latest best count that we can make there. Obviously not going to hit it. And so political season, you know, Mary Burke would be foolish not to talk about it.
Well, it's interesting if you think about past elections, if a major court ruling, say, on same-sex marriage came down smack in the middle of the election campaign, that would be a big issue. That would be big for both candidates. Nothing. They didn't skip a beat, it seemed like.
No, they didn't. They know what they want to talk about. They don't seem to be pushed from that too much. I would say Mary Burke in particular knows the message that she wants to hit home over and over again right now, and she's happy to talk about that 250,000 jobs promise, you know, as many times as she'll be given the chance. You know, Governor Walker has taken to arguing the jobs debate kind of on different battlefronts, and he's now citing in his most recent campaign ad, he's citing monthly job estimates that he really derided a couple of years ago as being prone to error. So, you know, he's looking for ways to you know, engage in that debate, too, that don't involve him saying, well, yeah, we're short of that promise.
Another bit of economic-related news this week, the administration announcing that the state collected $280 million, less than expected in revenues. How does this affect the budget and then the political conversation?
The budget in the short term is okay. I mean, those revenue collection numbers were through the end of June. And in the fiscal year that ended at the end of June, Wisconsin was in the black. The problem is we have a two-year budget here in Wisconsin. And the lawmakers and the governor, when they crafted that budget, left themselves very little wiggle room at the end of the two-year budget. And so that $281 million shortfall is enough to throw the two-year budget $115 million into the red. That doesn't even take into account the fact that, well, you know, revenue estimates are, for the next year might not be as rosy as we had previously thought, and a whole variety of other factors. So, you know, I think you can safely say right now Wisconsin is projected to run a deficit. This is the political season. I mean, that is one of the things that Governor Walker has pointed to, that I made tough decisions, but we balanced the budget. It's certainly harder for him to say that right now. He says he'll still be able to make moves within his administration that that can solve that that deficit, but he's not really transparent as to what those might be. We should know a little bit more about the state of things in October when the Walker administration puts out a more detailed report on these numbers.
Is this something that ultimately could fall back to the legislature to have to tweak and repair the budget come January?
Yeah, I mean, you're in this situation where, I mean, remember when Walker came into office in 2011, Wisconsin was running a projected deficit, and we had a budget repair bill that turned into probably the most famous budget repair bill in Wisconsin mm-hmm. history, where Act 10 was born. A lot of other things were introduced, you know, pretty contentious time. Balanced, they ultimately, you know, balanced the next 2 year budget, but this one is shaping up to leave the next governor and the next legislature, whoever they might be, with a deficit. It might not be a huge deficit, but I think you look at the numbers that are out there right now and revenue growth, you have to say there's a pretty good chance that the next governor and legislature come in January will have to be watching this.
And that's a long tradition, governors leaving a budget shortfall for the next occupant of the office?
Yeah, and I mean, polls are so close right now that might very well be Governor Walker, and it might very well be a Republican legislature. I think all you can, all you can safely say is that it's not looking great with the budget right now, and based on the best information that we know for sure, the state is projected to go into deficit.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's state government reporter.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Food Friday. Today, we're taking a look at a classic Vietnamese sandwich that's going through a bit of a renaissance here in the United States.
About a century ago, street vendors in Vietnam had the idea to combine the flavors of Vietnamese cold cuts and tasty toppings with the crispness of the French baguette. The result was banh mi, and our next guest is here to tell us how we can make this classic street food in the comfort of our own kitchens.
Joining us now is Andrea Nguyen. She is a food writer and teacher. Her new book is called The Banh Mi Handbook, Recipes for Crazy Delicious Vietnamese Sandwiches. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so very much for having me.
All right, we gave a brief taste in the setup there, but for someone who's never tried it, how would you describe banh mi?
Banh mi is sort of like your hoagie, your grinder, your Latino, your Mexican torta. It's a sandwich that has a really light bread on the outside, and the inside is a party in your mouth. And so you've got a little bit of meat, and then you've got pickles, and you've got cucumber and cilantro, chili slices, and it's all moistened with a little mayonnaise, and then you've got like this little salty, savory hit from this stuff called Maggi seasoning. And it's one of the things that the French, I think, brought to Vietnam along with the baguette. And Vietnamese people just kind of like took it in all different kinds of directions. And I loved how you said that it's undergoing a renaissance in the United States right now.
Well, and you grew up with it, right? Your family loved eating banh mi's. You sought them out and you started making them before too long. Can you tell us about some of your own personal history with the banh mi?
Yeah, I grew up making banh mi as a kid, and I just, you know, we'd grow up, you know, we'd be up in the morning, and my mom would just set out some bread, and it could be like sliced white bread. It didn't have to be like a baguette, to tell you the truth, because the word banh mi in Vietnamese means bread. But banh mi over time has become known as like the ubiquitous sandwich that I just described. So we'd, you know, get up in the morning, she'd have the bread out, and then she would have like some pate or charcuterie or cold cuts that she had made herself, and then some butter. And she'd just say, well, you know, toast the bread yourself and make your own little sandwiches. And then I also made them to take to lunch with me from things like liverwurst that I was like trying to doctor up as sort of my own version of Vietnamese pate. And so that was sort of a strange thing to bring to lunch, but you know, that was just kind of, that was, I really liked to eat. I was a chubby kid, and we started also going to Little Saigon. I grew up in Southern California, where there was a very strong Vietnamese population and the granddaddies of Little Saigons, and we'd go and we'd buy them, and they were like two for, you know, one, or three for two, and there were these really great deals. But they weren't really great sandwiches. So my family started making our own, and from the, you know, making the sandwiches from homemade pickles and, you know, mayonnaise, as well as all the charcuterie that my mom had already been making for a long time. So I kind of got sandwich obsessed from a young age, and it's just continued ever since.
Well, you mentioned just old, you know, plain old white bread, but you went on a quest to find the secret of making your own great bun mi bread. One of the rumors was it was rice flour. Was it?
It has nothing to do with rice flour, really, because it's like this strange, you know, like not even an urban myth. It's like an ethnic food myth. And people were just saying, you got to have rice flour in there because that's what makes it special. And in Vietnam, I think that some bakers were using a little bit of rice flour to make the dough bake into a very crispy loaf. It's humid and tropical in Vietnam. And somehow, you know, the bakers were able to figure out a way to make their lofty baguettes have like this really beautiful, shatteringly thin crust. And, you know, it was rumored that rice flour was key. And so there were these recipes that had like a lot of rice flour. And I tried them and I just got like these dense little baseball bats. And it just was not happening. Because, you know, now, I mean, nowadays, with all of the gluten-free thing, we know that rice is one of these things that does not have gluten, and we need gluten for bread to rise. We need something to structurally hold all of the elements together and, you know, for it to puff up in the oven. And so I just kept asking and asking and asking, and professional bakers weren't really willing to help me until I found, like, one person and two people to help me, and then I baked daily for, like, 3 months
wow.
to get a recipe that even my parents say, honey, this really tastes like the bread that we remembered when we were growing up in Vietnam.
Oh, that's a high compliment. It's what you wanted to go for. Well, so if you've got
if you knew my parents, if you knew my parents, that is a quite
tough critics, huh?
Yeah.
So if you want to, you've got this perfect bread, you've made that. What is the classic bun mi sandwich if we really just wanted to get a taste of what epitomizes a good bun mi?
Yes. So a lot of people, you know, the go-to bun mi is this thing called the Dak Biet. It's a special combination that's really a Saigon style bun mi sandwich. So what that has is this really light roll. And you can use like a roll, you know, just like a supermarket French, and I put that in square air quotes, baguette, or, you know, some other kind of light roll, even like a Portuguese or a Cubano roll would work, or a bolillo roll. And then you want to line it with a decent amount of mayonnaise, you know, and whole egg mayonnaise. Spread it all the way to the edge to moisten things. And then do sort of like a Jackson Pollock or Rorschach kind of treatment on the mayonnaise with this Maggi seasoning stuff. And that's sold at like supermarkets. You just have to hunt for them, as well as a lot of Latin markets and Asian markets. And so you just want to drizzle that on. And then from the bottom up, you've got a smearing of pate. And then maybe you've got little thin slices of head cheese. And then there's this sausage, just like a Vietnamese mortadella. And then maybe sometimes there's like this garlicky pork that's put in there, and it has like this sort of pinkish rind. None of this is mystery meat. It's all like made from like regular ingredients. It's just the way I'm describing it sounds weird. And the visual ratio of these meats to the vegetables, and I'm with regard to the vegetables, I mean, there's like this pickled daikon and carrot, and it's sort of like tangy. So it's sweet and sour, not sour sweet. And then you've got chili, fresh chili slices, cucumber, and then cilantro. So the visual ratio of the meat to the vegetables is like 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. So it's not a deli style, you know, sandwich like we know. So once that you put all of this together, just close up the sandwich, cut it in half, if you want to share, I guess. And start eating. And it's like a party or a carnival in your mouth because
wow.
you've got all these different textures. And that's why that bread, you know, people are like, what do you do about the bread? And I'm like, do not sweat it. But what you go out there, look for bread or bake your own. But what you don't want is bread that is really fancy, that has a really, you know, hard crust, that's super artisanal.
Gotcha.
Because that will that's going to scrape your mouth and hurt you.
I want to get to a recipe from your book that we've got on the Central Time Facebook page. It's the filling is shrimp in caramel sauce. What can you tell us about that?
That is something, you know, so the book, I just described it like this classic combination. And then for the book, I wanted to include, you know, riffs on banh mi. So, you know, if you know the foundations of how to make that sandwich, you can vary the filling, and you just have to keep, like, some fundamental aspects about the filling. And that's a great example, and I'm glad you brought it up. That shrimp and caramel sauce is a classic Vietnamese dish that you would make to eat with rice. And it has like this, the caramel sauce is not the caramel that you would put on ice cream, but it's like this bitter, sweet, nearly burnt sugar that we cook down, and then we simmer food in it. So it has like this savory, sweet quality. And so I made that up for dinner one day, and I had some leftovers, and I looked at it, and I thought, well, it's not too wet, and it's got a lot of great, you know, intense flavor. I don't need to eat a lot of it, a lot of that shrimp with my rice. And so, you know, there's like this like low protein, high flavor aspect. And then I thought, what if I put that in a sandwich? Mm. And the thing is that if you've got that pickle that I describe, the daikon and carrot pickle in your fridge, along with, you know, cucumber and cilantro and stuff like that. But, you know, it's, you can like make a sandwich. So I, because all you need is the protein, the filling. And I had this filling, and then I put it into my sandwich, and it came together marvelously well.
Andrea, sounds great. We're all hungry now, and we've got that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Andrea Nguyen is the author of The Banh Mi Handbook, Recipes for Crazy Delicious Vietnamese Sandwiches. And we were looking through that cookbook earlier, Veronica. And
yeah, there's a banh mi in my future.
Yeah, me
hopefully
too.
This weekend for sure.
Yeah, there's like some pork, garlic pork tenderloin one. I think that's what I'd try
and
first.
And there's tofu too, so yeah. A whole bunch of varieties in there. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.